Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Welcome to Podcast Like It's 1992, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1992. Here from our perch in 2023, I am one of your hosts, Phyllis Gove.
I'm your special guest host, Emily St. James, sitting in for your regular host, Joe Pesci's concussion. better joke, sitting in for your regular guest host, a heavily concussed Joe Pesci. There we go.
There you go.
Got it.
There you go. With us today, Caroline Framke, writer about town, as she has to be described. This is shockingly only your second episode with us. The first time you came on, we talked Hey Arnold.
We did.
A little bit of a stinker. Seems like there's a theme.
I mean, a little bit of a Arnold, stinker. Oh, Arnold is a little bit of a stinker. Arnold is a good boy.
And certainly Kevin McAllister.
Helga's more of a stinker than Arnold.
That's true. And that episode, by the way, that we talked about was amazing. Emily, are you a Hey Arnold? Were you a Hey Arnold fan?
I've never seen a single episode of Hey Arnold.
Oh, see, the thing is, you would love it. I probably would.
The thing is, everything at that time was of Satan. So
right.
I think I'm just a little bit too old for Hey Arnold. I was a Doug girl. Yeah. I love Doug.
Oh,
I watched that.
I did also love Doug, but I feel like you would understand Helga Pataki on the same cellular level that I did, and that would be very exciting for me to discuss with you. So,
not to mention the episode that we talked about, Emily, was an episode about mental health, which was about Helga going to a therapist.
Okay.
Called Helga on the Couch, which is tremendous.
That's great.
It's a great episode of television.
That's great.
We love TV episodes about therapy.
I love Doug so much that my middle name is Patty Mayonnaise. So...
good.
Here's the thing. We talked Doug in our 99 podcast as well, because Doug the movie came out in 99. But Doug the movie, kind of boring and not great.
I feel like Doug was good on Nickelodeon.
Yeah. Once it went to Disney, it was a totally different, less good story, even though Patty Mayonnaise had an excellent queer haircut.
Yeah. Patty
That was the one good difference.
Yeah. Who out of the Nicktoons is gay? Let's just get this out of the way.
This is our episode about which Nicktoons are gay.
Ren and Stimpy, obviously.
Yeah. I mean, are they?
They're in love with each other. That is a deeply toxic, deeply codependent, deeply abusive relationship between two men who once loved each other, but now have become tired of the very image of each other.
What's the name of the extremely gay squirrel in SpongeBob?
The little astronaut squirrel I don't remember. I've seen two little SpongeBob. All right.
Is there a Rugrat that's also potentially gay?
Sandy Squirrel. Sandy Squirrel.
Sandy Squirrel. Sandy Squirrel. Bill and Will's mom.
Yeah.
Okay.
Definitely okay. Queer.
Uh-huh. Angelica has big, like, Dom vibes.
Ooh,
like,
she could. She's not a weird thing to say about a baby.
Well, listen, they did Rugrats all growed up.
They did do that. So that's on them.
Yeah.
This is not on us anymore.
This has been our episode on Home Alone 2, Lost in New York. So, Emily, this is our first overt Christmas episode.
Yay.
You are the angel of Christmas.
I am.
And we do have, I mean, we're doing Home Alone 2. We're doing Batman Returns. We're doing Muppet Christmas Carol. Mm-hmm. Those are our three trifecta of Christmas movies. Is this, I mean, this is obviously an overtly Christmas movie.
Sure.
But I kind of feel like it's really just borrowing from the first Home Alone.
What?
So I guess my question to you is...
What? You think this movie's like the first Home Alone?
Yeah, no, I know. It's shocking. But where does Home Alone, and I guess Home Alone 2, rank in your sort of Christmas... Is it a Christmas favorite for you?
Home Alone, when I was 9, 10, I saw that movie in theaters, and then I saw it on VHS a couple times. I never owned the VHS. Mm. It was my favorite movie of all time. Like, sure, I was the exact right age. And at the time, people thought I looked a lot like Macaulay Culkin. A, because I did. And B, because they had mistaken me for young man Macaulay Culkin. So I was, like, very all in on Macaulay Culkin. Because I was like, you know, I don't want to perform masculinity, but perhaps I can perform child actor who's being taken advantage of by his parents. Like, that was a thing I could do.
Sure. Snarky young man.
Yeah. So I loved Home Alone. And then Home Alone 2, I was like hype. I was like, whatever development stuff I could read in like the Mitchell Daily Republic, which was not a lot. They didn't put a lot in there. I was just like, oh yeah, they're bringing everybody back. The whole crew coming back. Mm. Got Pesci and Stern, got Culkin. He got a big payday. I remember that being like a thing. And then I was in marching band because I grew up in such a small town that they had to have like I was like a sixth grader when Home Alone 2 came out. So I was in the marching band as a sixth grader, and we went on a trip to a town called Huron, and I went to like the bookstore in that mall, and it was, I think, like October, and they had the novelization of Home Alone 2, Lost in New York by Todd Strasser for sale. And I purchased it with my hard-earned money. And I read it on the bus home. And Becky Kaufman, who I had a crush on, who sat right in front of me, she went back up over the seat and she was like, how was it? And I was like, it's going to be better than the first one. And then I didn't see it in theaters. I saw it like 2 years later. And I was like, this sucks.
Wow.
That took a turn. I didn't expect that.
Turns. Do you still think it sucks?
Yeah, I do.
We're going to have fights then.
This is going to be great.
I think this movie is misses everything that makes the first one work. And I'm not one of those people who watches Home Alone, the first one, over and over. Like, I've seen it a couple times over the years. I think it's a perfectly fine movie. It's not one of my Christmas classics, but I do enjoy it. I think it's well constructed. I think it does a lot of things right. This movie... Even when I saw it at like 13 or whatever age I was when I finally saw it, I wanted to shoot Kevin McAllister in the fucking face. Damn. So,
shit.
Yeah.
So, Caroline.
On that note,
what is your history with Home Alone and Home Alone 2?
Well, I was thinking about this and I texted my parents to be like, did I see this in theaters? Because I was younger.
Yes.
I was like... I think like almost 5 when this came out, so younger, but like, you know, probably a little too young to see it. But yeah. I don't know. I was talking to my roommate. She saw it when she was 3. So parents were taking their kids. She was like, that was the first movie I can remember where like I laughed so hard I couldn't breathe. And I was like, you were 3. I don't know how she remembers this thing, which is, it's very cute.
That's really cute.
I asked them, they couldn't remember. I was trying desperately to think of when I first saw it. And I realized it's just kind of like, for me, Home Alone is, as Kieran Culkin says in the final scene about Santa Claus, omnipresent. It's always been around. for mm-hmm. me. I feel like it's how some people, Emily, feel about It's a Wonderful Life, not on terms of like quality, but just like it has always been a staple, or like how some people feel about Elf or A Christmas Carol or something. Home Alone is, it's just like every year it's on, I will, it's one of my few movies where like I feel like if it's on TV, I'm never gonna change the channel. It's like this, Back to the Future, and My Cousin Vinny, which I wanted to cover on this podcast, but I knew it would be very popular. So I picked this one to talk about what I thought would be a lovely shared experience in enjoying this film with the Angel of Christmas, who I now have found out is going to betray me.
Actually, the Devil of Christmas.
Is the devil. I'm the Devil of Christmas.
You're Krampus this episode.
Here's a fun story that just happened in my house. It's got three acts. Act one, I don't know. I can't find my water bottle. I'm looking around. Act two, I text Libby and I'm like, is my water bottle out there? Act three, she comes in, opens the door, looks around, points at it. It's right by my feet. That's a great story.
That's a great story about Home
Alone
marriage too.
Right, yeah. There. That feels like it really kind of sums up the whole thing. Yeah. I mean, I'll say this. I am, I believe, older than both of you. So
Boo, indeed.
If I could make it different, I would. I saw Home Alone, the first one, in theaters. I think I was about 10. I have a recollection of seeing it with a group of friends. It was never really my movie. Mm-hmm. I don't know why. And it's not even the Christmas thing. I mean, spoiler, I'm Jewish, but I love Christmas movies. So like, whatever. But it just ultimately, I'm not a slapstick guy. So much of this franchise is about kicking the shit out of adults and having them fall and hurt themselves and what have you.
Yeah, it is.
So it was a thing that as a kid never really worked for me. But subsequently, I've really come around on the first Home Alone, which I think is a really, as you said, Emily, like it's clean and it's like the premise is just so easy to understand.
The premise gets airtight.
Oh, it's like, perfect.
I was not a slapstick kid either, but the appeal for me was you're home alone.
You can
defend it, and your parents aren't there to terrorize you, mm-hmm. so you're great, and you can like set up death traps. It's fun.
It's a very clean premise. I'm going to be clear right now and just say I'm not going to be here arguing that this one's better than the first. I think the first one is better, like objectively better.
I don't mean to make this about the first Home Alone. We will obviously talk about the second one, but it's important to sort of compare
the two to
some
degree. You're talking about the first one because there is some overlap, I would say.
Some?
There is a little bit of overlap between the films.
The thing that ultimately, as I was rewatching this film the other day, that really hit me is, as we just said, how clean the first one is. And how sweaty the second one is.
Oh, the like sweat the to get into New York.
The gymnastics they go through to not just get him to New York, but to get him a hotel room.
Oh, yeah.
But to get him an abandoned house with which to then torture these. Like, you're just, it's just twisting itself in pretzels to get there.
I have some problems with this movie, but number one, I have one major plausibility concern. Mm-hmm. Like, there's only one in this movie.
Just the one? Okay, great. Let's hear it.
I'm a mother now. I have a beautiful baby. Yes. And if I, at some point in time, left my child home alone over the Christmas holiday, I would simply not allow my child to become lost in New York. I would be very careful. I would have them on a leash.
I agree.
They would be following me around everywhere from then on.
Yeah.
They'd be like 15 and they'd be like, Mom, please, please cut me loose. And I'd be like, no, you're never becoming lost in New York.
At the end of this film, spoiler, they're all around the Christmas tree. Everyone's getting the presents. And Kevin sneaks away. And I'm just like, how the fuck is this kid not like got some sort of lowjack on him at this point?
I mean, I think it's, I think there's something to the idea of like, it's this big family. There's all these kids. There's so much commotion. He is the youngest, almost littlest, because Kieran is technically younger, but he's playing his cousin. So he's like the youngest one who's like never, noticed unless he's making mischief. And I was rewatching Home Alone 2 and I was at first like, why are the parents sitting in first when all the kids are in coach? And I'm like, because they have a million children and they just want 2 hours where they don't have to do anything with these kids. And I think on some level, they're just like, it's just the kids become a unit. So for me, it's such a sweaty movie. everything about it. I am impressed every time I watch it at how they get him to New York, because I think it's actually, it actually totally makes sense to me how this happens. It's very, you could tell that they went through a million drafts to get that airport scene to make any sense. Of course, this is a pre-9/11 movie in about every sense of the word, from the way he gets on this plane without like showing anyone an actual ticket to him being on top of the Twin Towers to see the entire city. It's very stark. But, you know, you have every little bit of it make sense. They're rushing. They're late. He has his dad's stuff. The guy in a camel trench coat, because everyone wore that jacket. Like, and everyone looks like his dad. That actor looks like everyone. You know, running into the airline, the flight attendant, I am very impressed with the staging of that. I will concede that after that, it gets a little messier.
Two of us on this podcast are women, and all three of us do look like John Hurd. Like, that's just one of those things that's true.
You know, it's a skill, and you know, it's
true.
It's very important.
I agree with you, Caroline, and I truly feel as though the moment that the movie sort of gives up the ghost in terms of believability is truly the moment when the woman, the not even flight attendant, the person who works at the airline,
yes,
walks into the plane with Kevin.
Yes.
Kevin points the back of a person and says, "That's my dad." She's like, "Great, fine, have a good Christmas," and then just leaves and says, "Go find your seat." Like, truly, if just a monochrome of time was spent there, the whole thing falls apart. But like, they have to kind of breezy yada yada, and then he has to sit next to a person who doesn't speak English, and he has to put his headphones on so he doesn't hear that they're going to New York. It's just like, it's absurd.
It's just like, and it's also, you know, it's 92. I remember the first one, you know, when they call the cops to do the wellness check, the cops are kind of like, "Ah, your kid's alone, fine, we'll go," but they're not that concerned about it. Yeah. And like, even in this movie, it's played for laughs. I think a very funny scene with Catherine and John Hurt, where, like, you know, the cops, like, "Has this happened before?" And they're like, "Well, funny you should say that, but like, we never forget our luggage, knock, knock." Like, it's a funny moment. Mm. If this movie happened now, they'd be like in jail. Like,
in jail.
It just would not work. So I feel like it's at a very specific time. And it's just like, so I don't know. I'm always impressed with how they get to New York, but it is insane that like their premise was like, all right, so he can't do the house thing again. Let's get him lost in the busiest, most like dense city we've got.
You know how like jackweeds on the internet are like, remember, like trying to recapture their childhood, and they're like, ride bikes,
kids.
We could play video games and all this shit. Mm-hmm. And it's like, it's a thing that happens every time a generation turns 40. They're like, when we were kids, we had true freedom. And so like my fucking kid who's 1 year old in 39 years is going to be like, when I was a kid, I could run around wherever I wanted. And that won't be true. Like, we watch the baby all the time. But like, Home Alone 2 does to me feel like it comes from an era when children could just like roam around unsupervised.
Absolutely. And like, absolutely.
And also I mean, not for nothing, I think putting it in New York makes it so that, you know, because like for half the movie you're going, how is no one like, you know, people ask like, "Are you alone?" Whatever, but then they kind of just accept it, because in New York, that would be more reasonable. Like, to that, a kid would be kind of like, you know, a parent is somewhere else, and the kid's just kind of doing his own thing, or like walking across the street to the toy store, or whatever. And I do think that part of why I grew up loving this movie, or still like it more than both of you, is the New York of it. You know, not for nothing, beaming in here from New York City. I was going to apologize for any noise that happens, but I'm lost in New York, baby. So that'll be part of the vibe.
It is a love letter to New York. I mean,
it's a love letter to New York.
Yeah.
New York Christmas. And I was thinking about it, and I was like, you know, I can't speak to this because, again, I was too young to go to the theater at this time. But I do feel like there's something interesting about it being this love letter to a very family friendly New York in 1992.
In a time when it was not.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, making it like this lovely Christmas vibe. And I grew up in Jersey, and New York was right there, but far enough away that I could not access it myself. But it was like, you know, the dream is you go to the city. This was my fucking dream, to like be lost in New York. Like, so for me, I feel like there was this sort of like, I wouldn't have been as excited to be like home alone as I would be to be like at the plaza with running my ice cream cart running around. Like that would have, that was the dream. So I feel like there's that element of like, you know, my kid fantasy was more aligned with this movie. So I feel like that
makes sense.
Lined up for me.
Do you think the like Canadian knockoff of Home Alone 2 would be Home Alone 2 Lost in Montreal, and it's just like about a kid who has to go, and he's like, he like meets a scary unhoused Quebecois person, and is like
has lots of Montreal bagels. Yeah, I mean, I will say though, you know, to rewind just for a second to the parents of it all, the thing that I love about the first one is Catherine O'Hara's journey, right? Not just, you know, the wonderful scenes she has with John Candy, but who is sorely missed in this film, was supposed to have a cameo, but then it never happened. Catherine O'Hara's character, they give her nothing really in this movie. And not only does that feel sort of just lame, but it also removes the portion that you were sort of talking about of the parents feeling fully invested, or at least the mom fully invested. At least in
the
mom,
the dad
kid.
Is like, we have more like, where that AWOL, came whatever. From.
Yeah. but like, I just, it was one of those things that in this film, I really felt that vacuum. And I know that they filled that sort of, I guess, real estate with Plaza Hotel stuff and what have you, but you really do feel kind of that vacancy. And again, like, I don't hate this movie by any means, but I just feel like this is a perfect example of, you just shouldn't have made a sequel. Now, I get why you did.
Disagree.
The first, it made so much money. I understand. I get it. It's just not an easily sequelized premise, which we've learned from Home Alone 3 and Home Alone 4, I believe. And then they did another Home Alone.
Home Alone 3 kind of slaps. The genius of Home Alone 3 is that they're like, now it's a new kid. And you're like, okay. Like, once you are like, it's just always going to be a different kid who's home alone and it's different burglars. Uh-huh. Like you could just endlessly iterate on that. And the way that you can't, you can't have more kids become lost in more cities. I will say this. I think Home Alone 2 is fascinating. I would much rather rewatch it a billion times than Home Alone 3. I think Home Alone 3 is a better movie though.
That's interesting. I mean, there was talk of a Home Alone 3 with Macaulay Culkin.
Yeah.
That John Hughes, I guess, started, you know, outlining, which was going to be more, he's a teenager. I don't know what that looks like. That, I mean, I there's just in the sense of, so now we've got this, you know, prepubescent teenage version of this character. And I mean, I don't know what it looks like, but maybe there's something there. And ultimately Macaulay Culkin had walked away from acting at that point, and John Hughes said, I'm done. But I just think it's interesting. I'm going to give a little bit of context. After snarky youth Kevin McAllister, played by Macaulay Culkin, loses track of his father at the airport, he mistakenly gets in a plane headed for New York City while the rest of the McAllisters fly to Florida. Now alone in the Big Apple, Kevin cons his way into a room at the Plaza Hotel and begins his usual antics. But when Kevin discovers that the sticky bandits, because they're sticky this time, Emily, they're not
white. At least one is sticky.
It's true. Played by Joe Pesci and Daniel Stern, are on the loose. He struggles to stop them from robbing an elderly man's toy store just before Christmas. So Home Alone 2, Lost in New York, opened on November 20th, 1992, against Bram Stoker's Dracula, Malcolm X, Passenger 57, A River Runs Through It, Under Siege, and The Mighty Ducks.
Yeah.
It would go on to make $359 million on a $28 million budget. That's why you make a sequel. Home Alone 2 has 35% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics, 62% from audiences. Yes, Emily?
No, nothing. It did substantially underperform the first one in terms of box office.
Well, the first one made almost $1 billion. Yeah,
the first one, like I remember, like this movie, everyone was like, it's going to be the big movie of 92. Yeah. It and Batman Returns, and then both underperformed in a way that people found concerning. That sort of led everyone back to the drawing board. That said, they should have done a third movie with Culkin, Pesci, and Stern, and it should have been a dangerous game of cat and mouse, and that would have been great.
The most Home Alone, the most dangerous game.
It's just like Pesci's. It's like Pesci's got a sniper rifle on like the Sears Tower, and he's like, "I got you, McAllister." And like Kevin's running around downtown Chicago, and he has to complete various tasks.
Right. It's like I'm phone gonna, booth.
Let's to actually just let's like do that booth. Now. Kevin McAllister in his 40s, father of 17.
By the way,
because it's his way. And
if you did a Home Alone today with Macaulay Culkin, that movie would rip. Like, people would go and see that movie.
The problem is that Kevin McAllister at 40 works for Raytheon and has like.
Yeah. And he's
that
like,
kid went to MIT and developed arms. Like, he is very smart.
It's like,
it could get pretty dark.
It's but like, interesting.
It's like Hook, where you're like, this boy who never could grow up now has grown up and he's depressing and sad, but he's got like a daughter. And now that daughter has come under the fire of Joe Pesci.
I think it needs to be said. That Emily just said dark and sad, and Caroline said your favorite.
She lit up.
I also don't like Hook, but
that one's one I missed. I feel like it's very interesting.
Just opened the door to our office and looked at me and said dark and sad.
Did I not say?
I am pitching Taken in the Home Alone series.
Oh my God, that would be good.
But here's the thing. I'm kind of surprised in this nostalgia porn world that we live in, where everything is rebooted, everything is revived, that someone hasn't gone to Macaulay Culkin and said, like,
I'm sure they have. I don't know that he's interested. I mean, which is fair enough. I would like to note also that, speaking of the Home Alone sequels, we have not talked much about, like, there is a portion of this film that takes place in Chicago in the beginning. And I would like to discuss the Christmas pageant, which is a disaster, and it is unfairly pinned on young Kevin.
Yeah, because Buzz is a dick. Yeah.
Buzz is a dick. I almost called him this because I always get them confused, and I think it speaks volumes. I almost called him Biff, as in Back to the Future Biff. Sure. Very similar vibes.
Similar vibe. Yeah.
In the sequels, let us note that Biff is a Chicago cop, and you know what? Tracks.
Yeah.
Shitty little apology where he's like, you know, he gives this great speech. The timing on that's very good. That kid is very good with that. And then he's like, you know, does that little like side thing to Kevin and is like, beat that, you little trout sniffer, which let's not examine what a trout sniffer is much further. But in that moment, more so than the first one where Kevin is genuinely a jerk, this one, it's like, no. His much older brother very visibly antagonized him in front of everyone, and then the kids all fell over very dramatically in a domino effect that I don't think was his fault.
That would happen. Yeah.
He's singing that Christmas tree song, which I think was made for this film, co-written by Alan Menken. This Christmas tree song. I will note that the one text I got from Emily as she was watching this film was, "It's a good thing Kevin McAllister is such a simp for Christmas trees."
I mean,
because that comes back around. About
this movie, very early on, there's a scene with Catherine O'Hara and Macaulay Culkin, similar to the first film, where, like, basically, you know, he's complaining, she's put him up in the attic again. And there's like a list of things that get checklisted. If I remember correctly, Kevin's recording device, the Plaza Hotel, an inflatable clown, the dad unplugging the clock, Kevin's love of Christmas trees. It's all right there.
Mr. Police, he gave them all the clues.
It's the snowman all over again. It's all there for you. I want to read just a small portion of Roger Ebert's 2-star review.
Oh, it's so good.
I have a feeling that Home Alone 2 Lost in New York is going to be an enormous box office success, but include me out. I didn't much like the first film, and I don't much like this one, with its sadistic little hero who mercilessly hammers a couple of slow-learning crooks, nor do I enjoy the shameless attempt to leaven the mayhem by including a preachy subplot about the pigeon lady of Central Park. Call me hard-hearted, call me cynical, but please don't call me if they make Home Alone 3.
I hope someone did call him.
Ebert? Liked Home Alone 3 better than the first two Home Alones.
I think he gave it three stars,
and he gave the other two 2.5 and 2, respectively. So
I've not seen Home Alone 3. Have you, Caroline?
I think I did, but I got to tell you, I was not interested at the time.
The thing about my pitch for the new Home Alone is that they've made 6 Home Alone films now. And yeah, two have been TV films and one was directed to Disney Plus and came out during the pandemic. So nobody, but they're all about boys. And the thing is, you need to, like, girls are little stinkers in different ways.
Let's go.
Yeah, you need that. So Kevin's got a beloved daughter.
You got to meet Helga Pataki.
Yeah, she gets home alone. Joe Pesci. Yeah, it writes itself. Huh? The dangerous game of cat and mouse between Joe Pesci and a 9-year-old girl in downtown Chicago.
I will say I wrote down a line from I wrote down another line from Ebert's review because I was looking at the reviews because I saw that most of them were rotten, as the site says. And you know, look, if I had to review this film, yeah, I'd probably not give it a great review because once you have to think about it, it's you know, it's all fine. But a common theme across all the negative reviews was that all these adult critics thought it was maybe a bit much the way Kevin tortured the crooks in the abandoned brownstone. And Ebert wrote, quote, "The problem is cartoon violence is only funny in cartoons. And I would like to say hard disagree to one of the greatest of our profession." He was wrong. It is.
I agree with that, too. That if you're
us and Uncle Frank will think it's very funny.
But it's also like he mentions the whole like Looney Tunes component of it all,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
That it feels like it's, you know, they're Wile E. Coyote and he's the Roadrunner. And I think if you think of it on that level, it does work. You know what I mean? Like, I think you just have to kind of turn your brain off and enjoy it. But I also think that, as is the case, I imagine both of you can attest to this, but like critics don't love sequels, right? Like you're predisposed to kind of be like, really, you're forcing me to potentially watch the same movie again, which sometimes it is. And this film is very similar to the first one.
Yes, so I mean, that's part of the first you're one. Definitely, I would have, if it were me reviewing it, I would have gone into it being like, so what else are you bringing to this that you didn't in the first one? For me, that's New York, but that's about it.
Yeah.
Also, the sequence at the end, I don't know if, do we go chronologically or just, can I jump around?
We'll jump through.
All right. Yeah. I mean, that sequence at the end where I get extremely sweaty, how he gets them to that brownstone. Impressive, but sweaty. It is much more intense. Daniel Stern should have died 20,000 times.
Oh my God.
And at one point becomes
bricks to the head.
Four bricks to the head, electrocuted, does Herman pointed out that it's very the skeleton is actually Chris Columbus repeating the Planes, Trains, and Automobiles moment. An electric skeleton.
Yes.
But I would also like to point out, just in Kevin's defense, were I his lawyer, that these two thieves, the movie works pretty hard to make them deserve it. Not that like anyone deserves to be like horribly tortured, etc., disclaimer and so on. But you know, their Christmas Eve is going to be stealing from the sick children and then killing a child in cold blood. They say many times, they're just going to shoot Kevin in the face. They're like, I would love nothing better than to see you dead in the snow in Central Park. So like, throw a brick at them. He's going to kill you.
Sure. I do like your legal pitch though. The legal sequel of Kevin on trial.
Just self-defense.
Yeah.
Classic self-defense.
I think there is a calibration in the first movie that this movie can't quite solve. And I'm gonna say, I think this movie's pretty good through the Plaza Hotel. I think the Plaza Hotel stuff is cartoony, but like the cartoon logic of it more or less works. You have to buy that Tim Curry is the dumbest man alive, but also the only person who's like onto this kid. He's good.
Great.
But
the Grinch smile. It's like, what are you going to do? It's a perfect moment.
The second you're like, okay, so Pesci and Stern are back and they just happen to run into Kevin in the biggest city on earth. And Kevin happens to know the time and date and everything of when they're going to strike and what they're planning to do. Yeah, they told him what
they're doing. They were very excited about their plan.
And he like doesn't want to tell any of the authorities because, and here's where I can get with Kevin because Kevin's like ACAB. Kevin's like, he understands, can't necessarily trust the police because they're not maybe going to like help out at a toy store because they're going to be too busy like not doing things. But once I think there is a thing, it's a very obviously scholars have written about how the first Home Alone is a very conservative film, but it's a very primal desire to defend your home, the place you live. I don't have that desire to defend like an East Village Reno, you know, like I don't really feel like, okay, well, we're renovating this brownstone in the East Village or wherever they are. And like, I think that that just kind of breaks the movie. They have to work so hard to make the thieves such horrible bastards that the stakes get blown all out of proportion in a way that like, yeah, it just ends up making the movie feel a little bit cruel in a way that I think doesn't service it. And I think they should shoot Kevin and leave him dead in Central Park. I think that's a good ending.
You're going to shoot my client.
That's amazing. I'll say this, though. I agree with you, Emily. And I wonder if they had made the third act or the big kind of set piece at the end, the toy store, rather than the house.
Right. Like, why is he not defending the toy store?
First of all, it seems like a no-brainer just in terms of kids and fucking Toy Story.
Production design, that would have been
production
great.
Design, they've got that set. And I just think that it would have been a lot more visually interesting on top of everything else, because that, like a place under construction is really bleak. The whole thing felt like Panic Room. Like, it was just like, what exactly is going on?
It's very intense.
Oh my God, Fincher should direct my Home Alone sequel.
Yes. Great.
Get him on there.
But it felt like a real wasted opportunity to me, because it's like, rather than using the toy store is really just a linchpin to get you to another place. And I just, it's unfortunate. I imagine I'm sure there were reasons behind it. I'm sure it's much easier to pull off, you know, these various things that he does in an abandoned warehouse space or whatever or a house. But it just feels like a bummer to me.
Yeah.
It just doesn't work.
But that I can respect. And I also do think that they're, you know, in the second one, you don't have the Catherine O'Hara subplot, which is so good and full of so much emotion and like really tied to it. And also, you know, makes you feel a bit better about the fact that he is home alone because she's trying so hard to get to him. This movie has the complication of like, she doesn't even know where to go. Like, she doesn't know whether, like, which city to go to. Fine. But I do think, you know, you lose that. You gain the plaza. You gain Brenda Fricker as the unhoused pigeon lady. Yes, Academy Award winner. You have that. You have the plaza, which kind of serves the same slapstick that the thieves serve in the first movie. And to me, the thieves are the hat on the hat in this movie. Like, they only come back because they have to come back. Like, there's kind of no reason to have them there.
If this movie put Tim Curry in that role of the thieves, I think it would work so much better. I don't know. Now you run into the problem of why.
Right. Like,
Kevin...
Tim Curry should be, like, he is an adversary, but he's not the adversary, and I don't know why. Right.
Now you have the problem of why is Kevin beating up a hotel employee, but like,
to be fair, the hotel employee crept into the bathroom thinking.
I was just going to say, what is he doing? Fuck.
This is true.
Like, I also say all this knowing that if there were a 40-minute short movie that were just him torturing those guys in the brownstone, that I would watch it every Christmas and I'd laugh every time. like that sequence, it's so extraneous. Like, this movie's also longer than the first one. It's so unnecessary. And I'm doing heavy air quotes for the people who are not watching this on your Patreon. It's so unnecessary. It makes me laugh so hard every time. And I don't know what that says about me, but it's so funny. So to me, I can't get rid of it, even though I know, narratively speaking, there is no point. There is no point to having that there. I just love it on a primal child loving to see the adults get electrocuted way. It's not great. I'm not coming out of this looking great, you guys.
Well, I mean, I
think it's
funny. Actually, this time around, because I, you know, listen, I've watched Home Alone a whole lot of times, but like, I haven't actually like paid attention to a Home Alone film in a while. Right. So I'm watching this film and it is pretty gross and mean.
He gets
shot in the ass and in the dick and in the face giant staples.
I think it is not. There's definitely a couple things that are worse than the first movie, but I think the first movie has similarly vicious pranks that just don't seem as bad because they're not in the house of horror.
Yes.
They're in the warm, they're in the house that is also
absolutely
decorated to look Christmassy. Yeah. Like, that house is Christmas colored. That house would look insane in the summer. Like, all the wallpaper is red and green. Like, it is such a warm house that I think it softens it, right? But then you take them to the cobweb empty house, though it also gives you one of my favorite lines of the film, which is when Daniel Stern falls to the bottom of the brownstone, looks up and goes, "Wow, what a hole." You're not going to get that anywhere else. Where are you going to get that?
I mean, Daniel Stern is fully committed in this movie is a lot more. I would argue, I mean, obviously you have the water and oil of Harry and Marv, but like, he really popped in this movie more for me.
Duck
like,
Brick Kid? That is so funny. So funny. Suck Brick.
When he smiles for the camera, like he he's pretty fantastic in this. But
it's also interesting to remember that like he was filming City Slickers during the first one.
Correct.
So first one comes out, then it's City Slickers, which he's so good in.
He's so good
in and that. Then it's this one. And also Joe Pesci has My Cousin Vinny this year. So it's just like an interesting little.
And Pesci's won an Oscar.
Yeah. Oh,
Pesci's won an Oscar. He does not get nominated for My Cousin Vinny for some reason.
Which is crazy. But, you know.
Bill,
you very recently said shot in the ass, the dick in the face. And that is a great that is a great club anthem. I just want to say, like, we're going to set that to like.
I do love there's a description of Macaulay Culkin / Kevin McAllister on Wikipedia that says Macaulay Culkin as Kevin, a 10-year-old boy with a penchant for creating harmful inventions, which I think is a pretty fantastic way of describing him.
This kid, like, the physics involved in everything he does. This kid is brilliant, and his family has no idea. I'm worried about who he is right now.
It's pretty incredible.
If we know who he is right now, because it's like about the lost promise of like
war this criminal whole now, Emily.
Generation of people. He's a weapons manufacturer, and he's like, "What is the world I'm gifting to my beloved? She should be played by the girl from Florida Project, so you're because you know she could kind of play that sad note." It just like it should be like a serious movie that also has like a House of Horrors death trap sequence, but played like it should be like what? Okay, so obviously one of the most obvious follow-ups on Home Alone is Saw. It should like we should find the middle ground between Home Alone and Saw, and that's where this movie lives.
Wow,
should we find that? Do we need to find that?
I am going to find it. I am no longer on strike. Walt Disney himself should call me.
True.
Enjoying how Emily and I are fully going off the rails and Phil's just sitting
there. No, it's great. I'm trying. I do want to talk for a second, Emily, about someone that we have discussed before on our 99 podcast, but it's worth discussing again, which is Christopher Columbus.
Yes. Oh, hell yeah. I was looking him up. His... number one rated movie on Rotten Tomatoes is, I want to be clear, an abomination. I cannot believe what his highest rated movie on Rotten Tomatoes is.
Which is what?
Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets. Now, I have problems with the Harry Potter franchise.
No, but it's as... many reasons, he didn't do
that is the worst Harry Potter movie. Hands down the worst. How is it top rated on Rotten Tomatoes?
How is it top rated over the first
Harry Potter? How come, Chief Willoughby?
I don't get... So Chris Columbus is one of those guys who, if I remember correctly, when Emily and Libby came on to talk about everyone's favorite film, Bicentennial Man, on our 99 podcast.
Oh, my God.
We did a little bit of a deep dive into Chris Columbus. But I do think that, and I believe, Emily, you said Blank Check should cover him.
I was thinking that while watching this film. Genuinely, I was like, and I will go on and I will talk about this film again.
It'd be an interesting series.
It would. I mean, he has had such an interesting trajectory. I'm sure you got into it at your thing, but one thing I was thinking I'm sorry, you had a prompt.
No, I was just going to say, you know, obviously just for our listeners, you've got Gremlins and Goonies in 84 and 85, which he writes. He does not direct those films. His first directing effort is Everyone's Favorite Adventures in Babysitting, which is, I think, a legit great film. I loved it as a kid.
I've not seen that.
Oh, I think you'd really like it. Don't watch it on Disney Plus because they get rid of the one fuck that exists in that movie.
Oh my God.
It's a real bummer. Okay. And then ultimately Home Alone in 90 is sort of his follow-up. He has a film called Heartbreak Hotel that I've never heard of. But Home Alone, Only the Lonely, kind of an underrated film, a film that I think Emily might like. Is that a movie you've seen, Emily?
It sounds sad and dark. Suitably bleak. Yes, I was going to say. Lonely.
I remember when that movie came out, I was all in on John Hughes because of Buckin. Sure. And the Hughes Columbus, like, I was like, those are my guys. Because of Home Alone. and I didn't see Only the Lonely, but like all the press around it was like, John Hughes has lured Maureen O'Hara back to acting. And I was like, she was in Home Alone because I thought she was Catherine O'Hara. So I just was like, yes, I mean, she hasn't been gone that long. Right.
But Only the Lonely is a movie that doesn't really perform. Home Alone 2. Then he follows that up with Mrs. Doubtfire, which is a fucking gigantic hit. Mm-hmm. A movie that I don't love, but I think has a soft spot in a lot of people's hearts.
Do you think that when he got hired to direct the Harry Potter movies, J.K. Rowling was like, I got to check this guy's filmography, and she watched Mrs. Doubtfire and was activated?
Yeah, she was like, great.
Well, no, I bet she didn't see that, because that would have lost him the job.
I'm never gonna forgive J.K. Rowling, but if she was like, my bad, I watched Mrs. Doubtfire, thought it was a documentary, I would be like, you could get there. Just you got to do the work, J.K.
Yep. For sure. He does 9 months, the Hugh Grant, Julianne Moore movie where Julianne Moore has a baby. That's basically the premise of that film. Stepmom, a movie that people seem to love
that movie.
I think it's saccharine as shit, but some people really love it. Bicentennial Man, the aforementioned Bicentennial Man. He then does the 2 Harry Potter films, Christmas with the Cranks. Is that a film you like, Emily?
He doesn't direct that. He produces and writes it. I gotta ask you, Phil, have you gotten cranked?
I have not gotten cranked. Should I get cranked?
I watched that movie in a bar in Christmas 2019. I watched it with the captions. We had our Arden holiday party at a bar in downtown LA in 2019 when we thought that the world was never going to end. And Christmas with the Cranks was on. I'd never seen it before. And it is there's this like weird tradition of Christmas movies that are trying to be Home Alone, but are just like, God, Christmas fucking sucks and I hate it. And then at the end, it's like, oh no, I love my family. And you're like, no, what? And they all came out in the 2000s. Christmas with the Cranks is one of the worst of them. But Phil, yes, you should get cranked.
I'll get cranked. He then, for reasons that still baffle me, is handed Rent.
God, that's right.
Nobody else wanted to make it. Like, they were like, this can't be done. And Chris Columbus had a vision. He was like, you bring back the original cast. They're all so much older.
So old.
The vision was wrong.
It's so strange to me because, I mean, I guess to your point, Emily, 2004, 2005, or however many years they're trying to get this thing off the ground, is just not a time really where... it is post Chicago and Moulin Rouge. And I think they're probably thinking like musicals might be back. Maybe we can do this, but it's just very strange. It's very strange that he did it.
Yeah.
It's also this period when people want to make musicals, but there aren't a lot of musicals to adapt that you're not just remaking.
Right.
And honestly, like that's been a problem throughout. Like we still are not in a world where people could make the Book of Mormon movie or the Hamilton movie because they've been running so long. But like, for instance, I believe the live action Lion King was supposed to be an adaptation of the stage show and then it turned into an ungodly monstrosity. But yeah, like, we are in this world where people kind of just have to keep making the same musicals. And so Rent was like this thing that should have worked.
Right.
And yeah.
Mm-mm. Ultimately you needed not a gun for hire, which is kind of what Chris Columbus is. Like he's very competent. He's a guy who's going to, you're going to get your days. It's going to look fine, but it's going to be a little soulless.
But you will get a Christmas scene no matter
you
what.
Will definitely.
Maybe that's why he likes it. It is set at Christmas.
Christmas bells are ringing. You can hear.
And then he does the Percy Jackson movie, which was supposed to be a franchise, a movie I've never seen, a movie that has been now adapted into a Disney Plus show, which is, I guess, starting in the next couple of weeks or whatever.
Were they books first?
Yeah, they just adapted the books, right?
Yeah.
For the show. They were like, we got to get back to basics.
Well, the book was supposed... I mean, The Lightning Thief is the first book. Like, he thought he was being handed another Harry Potter.
Right.
And that just obviously didn't happen. He does Pixels in 2015, everyone's favorite movie, Pixels, about video games coming to life in New York, I guess, and Adam Sandler fights video games or something. And then the last movie he did was The Christmas Chronicles 2. Emily, have you seen the Christmas Chronicles movies?
I've seen The Christmas Chronicles 1. I've not seen Christmas Chronicles 2. Christmas Chronicles 1, kind of good. Not great, kind of good.
This is like Kurt Russell is Kurt Russell's.
That I would fuck that Santa, but he there's a scene
he's omnipresent.
Where There's a scene where he goes to jail and like the warden is Winston from New Girl, Lamorne Morris. And then like the next cell over is Steve Van Zandt. And like Steve Van Zandt's like, I got a blues band here with me. And then they all perform. And like Kurt Russell just has some sunglasses. It's so
Steve Van Zandt, the writer of the Christmas song that Kevin crosses the bridge over into New York too. That was a
I feel like we'd be remiss if we didn't, for just a very brief second here, talk about Macaulay Culkin's career as an actor. He obviously is in these Home Alone films. His father says that the only way first of all, it should be said, Macaulay Culkin is paid $4.5 million and 5% of the film's gross to appear in this film, as opposed to the $100,000 that he got for the first film. And one of the things that is
correct.
Sure. Yeah. One of the things that his father demanded was that he be able to do The Good Son after it. Like that basically I think they might've actually been shot. I don't know how they were shot, but he wanted to make sure that Macaulay didn't get pigeonholed. And he thought that The Good Son was going to change everyone's perspective of Macaulay Culkin. The Good Son, a movie I saw as a kid, kind of scared me, kind of messed me up a little bit. She drops him off a cliff. It's pretty fucked up.
It's a weird move to be like, he can't do this family friendly Christmas movie until he does this other upsetting film. Unless I know that he's going to do this deeply upsetting film.
Yeah, it's very strange. But, you know, he does that. He does The Nutcracker, Getting Even with Dad, where he gets even with his dad, I believe played by, is it Ted Danson? It is Ted Danson. The Pagemaster, Richie Rich. You ever see Richie Rich, Emily?
No. I was a big Macaulay Culkin fan, but I did sure. not.
I have not either, but I assume it's just the limo scene just for 90 minutes?
Yes, for 90 minutes. Great. Yeah. And that's the end. He walks away in 94 after Richie Rich. And my assumption is he is rich and ultimately doesn't care, decides he doesn't want to be in films anymore. He's in a handful of movies over the last, you know, between 2003 and 2019. But I mean, six movies in, you know, over 15 years. It's just not really
like good. He mostly acts now if like a friend of his or his longtime romantic partner, Brenda Song, are making a movie and they like corral him into doing it.
Yeah, he was in a season of American Horror Story, double feature, which is one that I didn't see. I don't know. He was in five episodes of Kings. Did you know that, Emily?
Yes,
I did. Yeah. I've watched Kings, so evidently I knew it at one time. But
that's pretty crazy. And okay. You're absolutely right. You know, he doesn't need to do shit. And
oh, he's like, good in Righteous Gremlins. I almost said. There we go.
But yeah, it's an interesting thing that he kind of walks away. You know what I mean? Like,
good for him.
Right, exactly.
He was the subject of so much scrutiny. And something I was thinking about a lot while watching this was actually the Harry Potter reunion special, which I had to review. And something that was interesting about it, I talked a lot about Chris Columbus, obviously, and he was featured and everything. That reunion special went through all the films, which was kind of an insane thing to ask them to do in like an hour. But when they were talking about the first couple and the process of getting cast, making these movies, being so young, like the three main ones, Emma Watson, Radcliffe, and Rupert Grint, they were all like, you know, Chris Columbus made, you know, was so specific about the set and what they could and could not do, and was very protective of the kids in a way that it was clear that if it were not Chris Columbus in the first place, that it could have gone in a much different direction, and the standards for their careers or what people were treating the kids on set like could have been very different. And that they were all very grateful to him for how he handled it. On the other hand, it also comes down to like their own parents, you know, protecting them in a similar way. And it seems like, you know, by all accounts, it's so nuts to me consistently how grounded and cool and funny Daniel Radcliffe appears to be after starring in that. Cause you know, it could have very easily been another Macaulay situation where he was like, spun off into a million other directions and then burned out in front of everyone. Obviously that did not happen, but I think it was interesting watching this and thinking about Chris Columbus as someone who directs so many kids movies, who clearly feels protective of kids on his set in a certain way. But I also wonder how much how much his handling of the Harry Potter kids was informed by what happened with Macaulay.
I was thinking the exact same thing as I was watching this.
Didn't he interview the parents of Radcliffe, Grant, and Watson just to sure they were like not shitheads?
That's smart. I think that's so smart. Because what they were asked to do to star in this franchise for their formative years, for like a decade of their like most formative lives, was an insane thing. And I truly am worried about whichever kids get cast in the TV show that, you know, Max is supposedly doing. We'll see if it happens. But I'm like, I in no way trust that it will be similar. Yeah. It will be as careful as Chris Columbus clearly was.
I remember when Stranger Things was new and they were just hauling those kids everywhere. I think that Netflix just had them in like a van and just drove them around.
Yep.
And I just was like, what is this doing to these? I think a lot about this as somebody who writes things that have kids in them a lot or young teens. Is it ethical to work with people? I'm not sure it is. And I love a lot of, you know, children's media. I love a lot of stuff that has kids in. I think there have been a lot of really great directors. Like we talked about on the Patreon, we talked about Celine Sciamma's Petite Maman, which I think uses child actors beautifully. And she figured out a way to do it without being exploitative. But I think to a certain degree, anytime you're asking a kid to do a job, you're like kind of ruining them a little bit. And to be clear, there's like Jenna Ortega, like when she was six, started doing dramatic monologues, and her parents were like, I guess this is what she wants to do. So they're like are exceptions.
Yeah. But like you hear someone like Mara Wilson talk about that a lot, being like, you know, she had a lot of experiences she wouldn't necessarily take back, but she is like, but I would never let my kid act. Like she's just like, that's not something she's interested in, perpetuating. There is a podcast I've been listening to a lot recently. It's Eating for Free by Joan Summers and Matthew Lawson, and they've been doing a really longer sort of child star hell series that like they're a few years younger than me, so their touchstones are different. But they've been doing a lot of the Disney kids, you know, like the Jonai brothers and Demi and Selena and Bieber and like, you know, but like Lohan, like all these kids who came of like that age, and it's just like, you go through the stuff and you go through how many of them got messed up. And those are only the ones we know about. And it's just the case for abolishing children's television is very strong.
Sarah Pauly in her book talks a lot about this as well, you know, in terms of what she went through on The Adventures of Baron Munchausen, but also just, you know, whenever she has kids on her sets now, and she had a whole lot of them for Women Talking, you know, she's very, very protective and very, and making sure that these kids are all okay. And her daughter wants to be an actor and is just like, she's really grappling with what that means. I mean, and whether or not she can even really in any way, you know, in support that. But she talks a lot about what you guys are saying, which is, you know, there's this inherent sort of moral question of whether or not we should even be subjecting children to this, right? They might want it, quote unquote, they might want the attention and they might thrive on, you know, what comes with it, but it's not healthy.
I think Selena Gomez is kind of an interesting case study because she wasn't horribly messed up, but she pretty clearly has, like, she's talked about mental health struggles. She like struggles to use social media in a way that like will be to the benefit of her emotional and psychological well-being.
Yep.
She's really good friends with someone I know a lot about, Taylor Swift, who had that similar thing of
Taylor
like,
Swift.
Yeah, that similar thing where she was like eight and was like, I'm a songwriter. Let's move to Nashville. And her parents were like, what? And they like dissuaded her. And then finally they did. And she, from all accounts, had great parents. And she's still, this might come as a surprise. There's a thing in Taylor Swift that's really like seeking other people's adoration and like interest
really
in
not.
Her.
I'm shocked. I know. And, she doesn't give that vibe.
And that's the thing I get, that even the child stars who didn't get totally fucked up by the process, either they kind of leave acting like Emma Watson seems to have done, or they kind of become like people who need that constant affirmation in a way that is maybe not the most beneficial to them. And like, obviously there are a lot of actors who need constant affirmation who got started when they were like 21, you know, like it's not like specifically a child thing, but it is, yeah.
But it's also like, you know, one of the more, I started listening to Eating for Free because they did an Ariana Grande series. And that one's always interesting because I always forget she started, like, I think it was a Nickelodeon show, right? I was too old for it, but it was,
yeah,
Victoria.
She started as a Broadway kid, which is right, so
Broadway
weird.
Broadway kid, yeah. Nickelodeon kid. And she has talked, she's more open about her stuff than I think Selena, like now she's not. She's definitely clamped it down in recent years. But I feel like Selena, like, even in like her documentary that came out on Apple Plus recently, she will not, I don't know that she ever mentions the word Disney. Like she will not go into it.
Does she talk about she's still friends with Barney?
She did not mention Barney, which I'm sure Barney did not appreciate.
Barney didn't come up.
But Ariana has always been very open about like kind of always being in identity crisis. Her sense of self is always in flux, and I feel it. And she has always tied that to the fact that like she was on camera during her formative years. She was part of this machine. And what's interesting about Home Alone 2, for as much as I love it and would never take it back, and how dare you suggest that the sequel shouldn't have been made, it is the moment that like it goes from a great, like airtight, family friendly holiday movie to like, this is a machine. Like, you know, now Macaulay is part of this like franchise. Now it's a juggernaut. It's making hundreds of millions of dollars, and that inherently makes it a completely different thing.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
No, for sure. I think that, you know, what I remember, and Emily, you kind of alluded to this, speaking of the machine, but you alluded to this earlier in terms of Batman Returns and this film were ultimately two of the biggest movies of the year, right? Batman Returns comes out in June. This comes out in November. Batman Returns had a very unsuccessful McDonald's campaign. McDonald's then went all in on Home Alone 2, and that was sort of their Christmas, Thanksgiving, McDonald's sort of push. But again, like, first of all, it's kind of almost wistful to think of a time when, like, basically that was the only kind of real promotional, like, it just wasn't the same as we are now, where, like, things are just so multifaceted. But it is interesting to me that for kids, the McDonald's Happy Meal was everything. Mm-hmm. And that feels like, first of all, that doesn't really exist anymore. Maybe it does. I don't know. I don't have kids.
It does,
maybe,
but not in the same way.
Not to the same degree.
Yeah.
It's just interesting because, like, Home Alone 2 doesn't really feel like a McDonald's friendly. Like, goes back to sort of why they should have had more toys. But,
you know. The one big toy, like the Talk Boy, the recorder thing,
course,
did not exist. It did not exist. And then right. It was in the script and they made it exist. And yes. I remember because I really wanted it and they had it. They had the Talk Boy, and then they had the Talk Girl, the purple and pink, and those are the two genders, Talk Boy and Talk Girl.
McDonald's did not have Home Alone 2 toys. Hardee's did. Because I believe McDonald's had the Aladdin toys.
Oh, Aladdin.
Oh, that makes sense.
And that's the thing about this movie and Batman Returns is Aladdin and the bodyguard eat their lunch. Aladdin and them just explode. Right. And like I'm looking at the Hardee's toys for Home Alone 2, and they do not inspire.
I mean, to be fair, what are they? What even are they?
Yeah, well, what do they look like?
You got, is it like here, a little Kevin and a Harry and Marv and like a little electrocution skeleton? Or Fun like, Meals, what are we? What
well, I'd buy that toy.
Fun Meals, each included, released on a weekly rotation. One of four sticker sheets, each with quotes and objects from the movie. One of four paper punch-out premiums of Marv, Harry, the Pigeon Lady, or Kevin McAllister himself. And a 12-ounce plastic collector's cup with a specific meal purchase. Hardee's offered free Home Alone 2 movie posters, four in all. These are not good toys. This is like Home Alone 2 didn't get the best people on it.
No, but it did get product placement.
It did get a lot of product placement.
Pepsi and to I do Coke, think it's funny. The Plaza, obviously. I'm really proud of us for getting as far as we did in this without mentioning the man who owns the Plaza. The,
Voldemort. Yeah, I will say that I do think it's... Yes, I do love... And do you guys... I mean, I don't know if you remember this. When there was a moment when... In Canada, they cut Trump from broadcast version.
For, and like that, they'd apparently been doing that for years. Because like that's just that you can snip that out of the movie real cleanly if you need to cut it for broadcast. And and then people were like, "Oh wow, Canada trying to start a international incident."
No, it's they needed it to fit in 2 hours, and the movie is 2 hours.
I mean, I do think it is.
What
first
if
that
started an international incident? What if we had gone to war with Canada over cutting Donald Trump?
I feel like it was close.
I mean, honestly, it might have been. I'll just say, though, I've stayed at the Plaza. I stayed at the Plaza when I was 16 with my parents. I don't get it, personally. I think it's pretty...
Did Donald Trump give you directions when you stayed at the Plaza?
He didn't.
Yes, famously, his directions do not actually... match what Kevin does,
correct,
which is very funny. It's just like he tells him the exact
it's the thing, like how Kevin knows not to trust cops, he also knows not to trust ahead of his time.
Which is, I mean, I think, like, you know, as with a lot of touristy New York things, the idea of it is better than the reality. It's an older hotel, people do live there. It just hasn't been updated much. I mean, what's interesting about this too is that I feel like one thing I always think of now when I think of this movie is, I think it was, maybe it was just last year. So maybe not always is a little bit of a stretch, but I thought it was very funny. Last year, this, British soccer player, the lovely, perfectly dumb, Jack Grealish, who if Jamie Tart from Ted Lasso isn't based on him, it's the resemblance is uncanny. It's, you know, he is that beautiful himbo. Mm-hmm. He, on his vacation last year, like they took his like goodwill and everything, and his vacation was New York at Christmas, and he was posting all these photos of taking the Home Alone 2 tour. He was like, he like took a photo of the Plaza and was like, Home Alone Plaza, and then he took a photo of the ice rink and he called it the Harry, and he called it the Harry and Marv ice rink, and I was like, he got this a pizza. He like went, like he did the whole thing, and it was like it was amazing. And I was watching this being like, you know, this again, I think like for a certain kind of kid, and I guess I'm calling myself a beautiful himbo, like that was like, what a dream.
That is such a good description of you. Beautiful himbo.
Thank you so
beautiful
much.
Himbo.
I feel like I'm really embracing that in my 30s. I'm just like, you know what? I don't know why I bother pretending like I have thoughts. I just want to watch a 9-year-old electrocute two men in a brownstone.
Oh, for just an amazing piece of odd trivia, Brenda Fricker presented Joe Pesci with his Best Supporting Actor Oscar.
Oh,
because she had won the previous year, but like the confluence of those things in Home Alone 2 is kind of fantastic.
I told my wife I was watching this movie, and she was like, "That movie's not very good. I don't remember that movie being very good." She and I are the exact right age to have, when we saw it, realized it was just a copy of the first one, and have been like,
"That was like one of your first movie disappointments."
Really,
where you were
like one of one of our first movie disappointments. She was like, "I don't remember that movie being very good," and I was like, "It's not." And she was like, and we talked a little bit about it, and she was like, "But Brenda Fricker," and I was like, "Who's like Brenda Fricker? Is there Home Alone 2 pull?" It's my wife, of course.
So. Well, but so Brenda Fricker talks about in the research I did that this is the only movie that anyone ever talks to her about, that anyone ever comes up to her about. I do want to. We need to talk about the Pigeon Lady. The Pigeon Lady, who feels Dickensian, like she's in a different movie. I don't fully understand.
Now, is she unhoused because her heart got broken one time? Is that am I correct on that?
It's such a wild. She stopped trusting people, is what she says, and she like shut herself off and became untouchable by amassing pigeons, pigeon army.
A baby has entered the chat. An adorable baby has entered the chat.
Hi, baby.
She's so thrown that you're not her grandparents, because normally when we're on talking on a screen, it's one of her grandparents. So
so I want to talk about the pigeon lady, because as I was watching this film, I was thinking about the penguin.
Of course,
Batman Returns.
I don't know why I just like nodded like that made any sense at first.
Well, they're both wielding birds.
Great.
They're both
on board. On board. Notes so far. Let's go.
They both seem. I feel like they could have been very happy together. I think if the pigeon lady and the penguin had got together, they might have been very happy. But it was one of those things where the pigeon lady is so strange. It's such a strange thing to insert into this franchise, if you will, because like I guess it's trying to be analogous to the elderly man next door,
right,
who is scary in the first film. So he's scared of this unhoused pigeon lady in this movie.
Feels like he should have learned the lesson. It feels like he should have learned the, like, obviously when you're a kid, you're scared of a lot of dumb things. Like I certainly was, but like by movie logic, he should have learned the lesson. It feels like a retread. I don't know.
It's a total retread. I mean, I will say that I think the pigeon lady might get a little more screen time than the gentleman from the first film. And I think that the first film, again, is just so much more kind of terrestrial and grounded. And the scene in the church with him and with Kevin and the old man is just a really lovely scene. And I think they're trying to recapture that by sneaking them into Carnegie Hall somehow.
I don't even think it's Carnegie Hall. It's like they filmed it in Chicago, but it's beautiful.
Yes, whatever it is. But it's fine. Because I know they filmed other stuff in Chicago too. Like the toy store, the front of the toy store is also a Chicago. It's not actually in New York. But and I understand that they're trying to sort of, again, Baby podcaster.
Do you have anything you want to say about Home Alone 2, which I didn't let you watch?
No.
Did she just wake up? She's looking a little like she
just woke
up.
Yeah.
So the Brenda Fricker thing seems like it's very much pulling on the same idea, right?
Yes.
Which is this sad thing happened to her earlier in her life, and Kevin's going to teach her how to get over it.
I think the one moment of it that I do really like is that, you know, he does his incredible scream, which, you know, Macaulay Culkin, yes, unparalleled scream, except perhaps Daniel Stern can rival him in terms of screams. Screams. And that he starts running away and then he stops and then he goes back because he thinks about it. And I think that's actually a really lovely moment to, you know, kind of take the specter of like the homeless crazy lady and have him reconsider it in that moment for no other reason than he's like, maybe he is thinking of the older man. I don't know. Maybe that's just me like giving them more credit than it's due. But I do quite like that moment to be like, well, you're actually just a person, aren't you? Like you are a human being.
I do like the end of him giving her the turtle dove. And like, I
can only think of the SNL sketch where it's like Kristen Wiig and I think it's Melissa Villaseñor were playing Macaulay Culkin, which is so good. And she's like, and Brenda Frick is like, oh, what are you up to now? And she's like, well, you know, like, here's your turtle dove. I'm off because I'm staying at the Plaza with my family. I've been using my dad's credit card anyway. Have a good Christmas. And like, so you have that moment where you're like, well,
I am so excited to announce that we've cast Brenda Fricker reprising her role as Pigeon Lady in Home Alone Generations-Carly's Day Out.
I really thought you were going to say Yellow Jackets, and I was like, oh my God, who's she going to be?
Exciting. Yellow Jackets.
Brenda Fricker's playing adult Brenda Fricker. We have to find a teen Brenda Fricker.
That's cool. I also found myself thinking of, this is maybe strange, but Harper,
what if the Yellow Jackets found like a weird old cottage in the woods and Brenda Fricker was just living there? I'm gonna pitch this today.
You should. I found myself thinking about Harper from Angels in America when she's living in Central Park and she's gone off her meds and she's just kind of talking to herself and burning down trees and starting fires.
Sure. Yep.
It just, I there's something about this idea of Central Park being this kind of way station for people that I think is quite interesting. And it, not just in this film, but it does feel like in general, there is this kind of, because it is the only park, obviously, you know, in Manhattan, there's kind of this almost a magic realism that mm-hmm. seems associated with it that I think is kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm. Have either of you seen the Christmas film, It Happened on Fifth Avenue?
No.
It's from the 40s.
Okay.
It is a really wonderful film about a rich man leaves his mansion because he's going to go travel to Florida or something, and a bunch of unhoused people move into it and have a lovely Christmas there. And that like has some of the vibe of what they're kind of going for with the Brenda Fricker character. But like, there is this tension in like, again, this is a fundamentally conservative concept, but they're trying to do something vaguely progressive with Brenda Fricker, but the two are at odds. So it's kind of like, well, I guess you're just homeless and that's fine. That's your lot in life. Yeah. Good for you. But in Home Alone Generations, Carly's Day Out, we're going to reveal that Kevin used his Raytheon money to buy her a house. So that's the house that's that true. Carly ends up having to defend. So
it does feel like, because I'm thinking about like John Hughes's filmography and this kind of, I don't know that it's a trope necessarily, but like Curly Sue has a similar kind of thing of like plucking people out of, you know, less than ideal circumstances, if it's being unhoused or not having money or an orphanage. Like he likes it. It almost feels fairy tale-esque, right? Of this right. idea of trying to kind of play in that world. Ali Sheedy, speaking.
The baby's leaving.
She's going to take a bath.
Oh yes, Ali
Sheedy shows up in this film for 5 seconds as a airline desk clerk. It makes me sad that that's where Ali Sheedy was in 1992. Since she's really
did she talented, not just but... like maybe do it as a cameo? Does or was that like
maybe?
I don't know.
I mean, look, the one thing I think we can take from that is that everyone who's in this film is making crazy residuals off it still. And frankly, for the amount of times that it plays on television, they should. It's like, it's constant. And I think I was reading some interview with like, not a very good interview, but it was like someone had gotten a hold of the other McAllister kids who are just people who, you know, aren't still in the industry. And someone literally was just like, well, at the very least, this film has bankrolled my life for the last 25 years. Like they were very straight up about it.
Ali Sheedy did a lot of cameos in John Hughes movies. So I'm guessing that she did this as a favor to him. She had
John Hughes cinematic universe.
Yeah. Thing. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. She's always playing the same character too. So.
Oh, really?
No.
No.
Okay. I didn't mean that to sound as a slight against Ali Sheedy. I just really love her as an actor.
Also, so I mean, just like, you might have wanted her to be in it in a more substantial way.
More substantial.
Like as the Plaza Hotel person, even though Dana Ivey does such a good job with that. The fact that it's Ivey, Tim Curry, and Rob Schneider also. Like, what a trio. They do a great job. But one of my favorite lines of the movie is when Catherine O'Hara is like, what kind of idiots do you have running this place? And Dana Ivey goes, the finest in the city. And they just all beam. Thrilled with themselves.
It's a great moment
because they are so dumb.
I think that Rob Schneider met Donald Trump while making this film and he was activated. So that's Chris Columbus is responsible for so many of our problems.
All right. Well, then in that instance, I can't defend the film. This might be the moment where I admit that I didn't know that Angels with Filthy and Filthier Souls was a fake film until about 4 years ago.
Same.
Wow.
Same.
Really? I mean,
are you for real, both of you?
I was impressed with how he used this movie.
I would guess that I like was in my 30s. Like I probably Chris Columbus
did a great job recreating that vibe because I really didn't know.
It's crazy.
More movies should have fake movies that the characters use to fool people with.
I agree. I do think, just because it occurred to me as we were talking about Harry Potter a second ago, the John Williams score in this movie is very Harry Potter. The Home Alone scores, I feel like Harry Potter pulls pretty liberally from. My assumption being, perhaps that they were, it might have been used as temp score on the first Harry Potter, or whatever the case might be. But the score in this film is doing a lot of work.
It's so good. The score is so good. You know, the fact that it's like, it's clearly Christmassy, but then there's like a little minor key sort of like mischief coming.
Yes.
Like it's a little spooky, but it's mostly cheery. It like, you know exactly what vibe you're going for. It would be the fact that they then come together for Harry Potter makes absolutely sense. Absolute sense. And I was thinking recently about like, why the hell Harry Potter like marathons are like thought of as a Christmas thing. I know Christmas features in every movie, Chris but Collins like movie. So do a lot. But I think genuinely it's like, I think it's the score. It's very Christmassy. And it makes everything feel Christmassy.
I think it does. I think a lot of people feel this in a similar way about Lord of the Rings and rewatch it every. I think it's because those first two movies came out at Thanksgiving and it was just like.
Right. Thanksgiving. I feel very. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but yeah, I do think
that score.
I do think John Williams' score is so much of the success of Home Alone. Like it gives that movie a feeling of epicness that it doesn't really need, but that really pushes it over the top. He got two of his many Oscar nominations for Home Alone 1. And when I was a kid, I was furious that it hadn't gotten more nominations. I was like, that was a shoo-in for Best Picture and Best Actor, surely. and it was not. Although I do agree with Joe Reed of This Had Oscar Buzz that Catherine O'Hara should have been supporting nominated for that film.
I mean, I love that. So and good. I think there's a case for Macaulay. I don't know who he would have been up against, but I watching this movie.
I'm gonna pull it up for you just so you
fantastic. So I have to defend that. That's fine.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But I, you know, I'm sure another kid would have been as charming. You know, there are other charming kids. He is such a big part of the success of this, and especially because you forget until you have to pay attention to the structure of this movie how much of both Home Alones is just him talking to himself.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. It really can't sort of be undersold how good he is in that first movie. And I mean, he's very good in this one too, but like you're putting the entire thing on his shoulders, really. Like it doesn't work without him. And he's a kid on top of everything else. And as you know, as we all know, kid actors are tough. Like it's tough to find them. It's tough to sort of, you know, pull great performances out of them sometimes. But I will say, Emily, you mentioned Catherine O'Hara deserving an Academy Award nomination for the first Home Alone, which I agree with. That being said, it was a pretty stacked year. You had Whoopi Goldberg, who won for Ghost, Annette Bening for The Grifters, Lorraine Bracco for Goodfellas, Diane Ladd for Wild at Heart, and Mary McDonnell for Dances with Wolves.
I mean, I would sneak Catherine O'Hara in there over a couple of those. I might put her in over Bening. I love Bening and The Grifters.
What? I love The Grifters.
It's been a while since I've seen that. I might put her in over Mary McDonnell, despite my love of Mary McDonnell. And I do think she's better in that movie than the reputation of that movie would suggest.
Correct.
But she's playing an impossible part. She's playing it really well. I just looked up and discovered that Home Alone was nominated for 2 Golden Globes. Best Picture, Musical or Comedy, Best Actor in a Musical or Comedy for Macaulay. And
there
it
we
lost
go.
Both of those awards.
Two.
Green Card, a Peter Weir film. Do you think Macaulay Culkin is like still mad at Gerard Depardieu? Do you think like
for stealing
that
his
would be
club?
A great Probably. Rivalry? That would be a really good feud.
Do you think like Brenda Song, one of my favorite comedic actors, who I think should get more work? I just love her. Do you think she wakes up at night and is like, Macaulay's not here? And she goes downstairs and he's like leaning over like a mug of tea, just staring into it. And she's like, stop thinking about Gerard. And he's like, I can't.
You know what's interesting is that Gerard is nominated for Best Actor at the Oscars, but not for Green Card. He's nominated for Cyrano de Bergerac.
It was the year of Depardieu.
But to your question earlier, Caroline, Jeremy Irons wins for Reversal of Fortune. Kevin Costner, Dances with Wolves. Robert De Niro for Awakenings. Gerard Depardieu and Richard Harris for The Field. I think that Macaulay should have got in there.
You're just saying, fuck Depardieu. Let's...
Let's get rid of him.
I mean, yes, for real though.
Putting that on the record.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's I don't know. It's very strange. It's one of those movies. The first Home Alone is a staple. This movie feels like it's obviously leeching the love from the first one. Emily mentioned, you know, it does well, but it doesn't do as well as they thought it was going to do at the box office. I mean, listen, almost $400 million on a $28 million budget.
It did fine.
Ain't nothing to sneeze at.
Yeah.
But it is just interesting how the film sort of, its legacy, if you is mostly associated with the Plaza Hotel. I mean, it's kind of associated with Trump to some degree, the stupidity of him getting the cameo, whatever.
I think this movie, for me, and I'm going to stand up for a little bit, I think the New York thing is a much bigger part of its legacy than you're giving it credit for.
I think New York at Christmas has such a specific...
Fair enough.
Has such a specific stranglehold on, like, you know, I feel like New York at Christmas, like, that was a very, like, classic, you know, movies from, like, 30s, 40s, etc. And then it kind of, like, went away. And it became more, like, you know, A Christmas Story is very Midwestern, like, that kind of thing. And then I feel like this, you know, kind of harkened back to that New York at Christmas thing.
Everybody's trying to copy... Everybody's trying to copy It's a Wonderful Life.
Always.
And
the blueprint.
And then this movie's like obviously Scrooged and some other movies do New York Christmas, but like
I like Scrooged.
This movie, I don't. This movie is for a person who loves Christmas, I just am like, meh, on this episode.
It's because you like Christmas so much, you have high standards.
Yeah, I do. I respect that.
But yeah, this movie, like, I feel like this movie kind of walked so Elf could run, because Elf is like a really great New York Christmas movie.
I don't like Elf.
Listen.
Oh, wow.
Listen.
Oh, wow.
I'm not an Elf fan.
The Christmas
over here.
Off right
there's
now.
A, there are some, like, I think that Elf has problems. I think it has, like, substantial issues, especially in how it presents the romantic relationship, which makes no fucking sense. But it has a little stop motion narwhal that comes out of the woods. It's like, goodbye, buddy. And that's 4 stars right there. 4 out of 5.
Look, that's impeccable logic. I'm not going to fight that.
Yeah, there's something that you can't fight that.
Yeah, but like New York at Christmas lends itself to like hijinks in a way that other settings don't. So it's a very hijinks heavy movie. It's very slapstick in the way you were talking about earlier. And if that's not why you liked the first movie, then this movie's not going to be as appealing, because the first one is so good on, like, you know, ultimately, you know, it's him having this fantasy of like, what does my life look like without a family, but also what does home look like, and sort of creating a home for himself and a vibe and realizing that he wants his family. And for this one, it's just like, isn't this hotel great and fun? Like, it's not the same sort of like heartwarming fantasy in that way. So I can appreciate that, like, losing that element of it really does suck some of the like narratively complex aspects of it out.
The wish fulfillment of this movie is, what if I didn't have to go on vacation with my family? Which is like,
I mean, honestly, with that many kids,
okay, I can get the, but like, just go to summer camp, kid. Your parents can clearly afford it. It could clearly afford a like camp, nice summer kid. Camp
but then but summer camp is not with his family, right? So like, his idea is like, wouldn't it, what would it be like? I mean, this year I recently went on my first solo vacation ever as an adult person.
Oh, wow.
I went to Amsterdam for a week.
Ooh,
I know.
Very nice.
It was very nice. And I feel like, oh my God, there was one night when I did like the equivalent of like, I was like, I had a pizza alone in my hotel room.
Hey. Did you fold it like in green card?
You know,
green book? That
not,
is,
no, it wasn't a great pizza. It didn't matter. But it was like, I like that. The fantasy of the solo vacation, I feel like I get it. I understand it. And it really, it was great. And also very like interesting and different to be like, okay, so I don't have to consider this many people. What do I want to do? And to see, like, I'm not a person of youngest sibling experience. I'm an eldest sibling, but I can appreciate that as the youngest of that many kids who usually gets lost in the shuffle, that this, like, that is a very powerful wish fulfillment situation of him being like, I can do whatever I want to do.
I do think. Different. Now that we're having this discussion, I do think one of the problems with this movie is it is a Christmas movie. Not in the sense that, like, I think that's bad. I like that it's Christmas. I like the Christmas aspects of this movie. There's a big tree. New York at Christmas is... in 2016, after the election, was like, I got to get to New York for Christmas just in case. And I did. and it was all great. Right. I like talked Vox into like paying to fly me out there. I did work while I was there. It wasn't like it was like I was bamboozling them.
Yeah.
But yeah, I went to New York for Christmas. So I like that aspect of it. I do think there is a very interesting direct Home Alone sequel that is a summer movie that is like I'm at summer camp, I'm in a summer vacation rental. Like I think there's a lot of the stuff here is amping up the stuff from the first film because they have to. Summer brings you a whole new set of elements to play with. He can like drown him in a pool. That'd be great.
Sure. Or Thanksgiving.
But you don't get the same. You know? Or Thanksgiving, yeah, maybe, because it's one of the underplayed thing here. And I think it's, you know, it's the conceit to get him to be like, the robbers can't get away with it. Is like, you know, it's like, oh, they're going to steal from sick children. And that's like, it's like sick children at Christmas. What kind of monsters? And
that's kind of my favorite line in the movie. Where he says, you can mess with a lot of things, but you can't mess with kids on Christmas. I mean, he's not wrong. That's pretty fucked up.
You don't get the same thing with like, you can't mess with kids on the 4th of July. You absolutely can, and you should.
And you should. I do think that like there are magical things that happen on Christmas Eve. Animals gain the power of speech. Santa Claus can fly around the world in one night, and children can beat up burglars like with elaborate death traps. Those are things that are true.
Those are all things that happen.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, I kind of, as we sort of wrap this up, I feel like the end of this film, the end of this, it's not the end of this franchise, but it's the end of Macaulay being in this franchise, ends with, as I mentioned earlier, the whole family in a big hotel room at the Plaza. They got a whole bunch of presents from Duncan, the man who had the toy store, because Kevin threw a brick through the window with a note attached to it that said, I had to do this in order to get the burglars that were going
to
steal all your money.
The alarm.
Love the cop. Yeah. Talk about like inept cops. The cop picks up brick and says, hey, I think this is for you. Like, just everyone's just inept in this movie.
Kevin is the only one with any smarts at all.
Well, this is, I mean,
which
that's
is interesting,
also the,
but he's the smartest the person in this movie. Right.
Right. Which is like, kids are smarter than all the adults. All the adults are dummies, and the kids.
I do think that this movie, as much as I love Tim Curry's performance, and I think it pushes that logic a little too far.
Oh, completely. Angels are filthier souls, fools everyone.
I do love
Curry thinks an inflatable clown is a man in a shower.
He put a shower cap on it.
He did.
Anyone would be fooled.
Yeah. Caroline was locked and loaded with that, by the way. She knew it was coming and she was
I just thought it was a great detail. Why did he do that? It was funny.
I mean, it's an insane setup with the pulleys and the whatever in order to anyway, but it's a nice ending. It's a similar ending to the first one where the dad gets the room service bill. Cause like, there's a shot outside the house in the first one where you hear the parents screaming at Kevin about something, but I can't.
Oh no, it's Buzz's room was trashed.
Oh, okay.
What did you do to my room? But this one is the room service bill. And I find it very funny. And also like, frankly, quite fitting for a Trump owned property that he was like, I guess we have to give them a suite, but I draw the line at paying for the ice cream. They will pay for the ice cream bar. And I paused it to look at the bill. It checks out.
Does it? I mean, so the bill comes to $967 just in ice cream? And
No. It's two chocolate cakes. It's an ice cream bar. It's a pastry cart. It's like six flans. It's all... and 36...
You couldn't have possibly eaten all of this.
36 chocolate-covered strawberries.
It's like... You remember how a few years ago everybody discovered that Home Alone 1, there's that sequence where his ticket gets accidentally put in. And so like that covers up a certain amount of logic or whatever. And like nobody had really realized it until a few years ago. These movies are sticklers for details. They weren't just going to start Home Alone 2 with Kevin walking down Fifth Avenue being like, well, I'm lost in New York this time. They were going to show you.
I will say that like, if this was your first movie disappointment, I feel like this was my first, like, you know, being younger or whatever. I feel like in my head, it was like, oh my God, like the concept of like a callback or like setting the thing. So like that scene that you were talking about earlier, Phil, with like, here's the talk boy, this, that, and the other thing. I was like, oh my God, it's all coming back.
So for me,
like all the repetition and like the angels with filthy souls, I was like, oh my God, they got all of it in. they made it all, they put it like, I was
so it's all Easter eggs, but like not even good Easter eggs.
Like, I feel like it was my first Easter egg movie where I was like, holy shit, it's the same guy doing the same thing.
I used to have a feature. I used to have a feature at Vox called Critic at Large, Critic at Small, where I talked to
I love that.
My beloved editor's daughter, who when the first one we did, she was 4 and a half. And she grew up to like, I think 7 by the time we did the last one. Okay. And I think there should be a major motion picture critic who is just a really smart 5-year-old. Like there should just one of the our great publications should just every year there's a new very smart 5-year-old who writes movie reviews. Then they age out of the job and we hire a new very smart 5-year-old.
I mean, was it Mike Ryan who did a someone recently did a review, but it was like it was Paw Patrol. And he was just like, I went to see it with my kid and I don't know what to say about it, so I'm just gonna ask her questions. And I respected that.
That sounds fantastic. So, Caroline, at the end of our episodes, we rate our films. We rate them from 0 to 99, 0 being the lowest, 99 being the highest. We rate it back in 92 or when you first saw it, and then we rate it today as to how perhaps your perspective has changed on this. I had not seen this film in 92, weirdly. I saw it like later, and it doesn't make sense for me to rate it then. But I came into this podcast at a 60. And after this conversation, I'm going to hold it a 60. I think this movie is like a solid 60. I don't think it's a great movie, but I get it. I understand why people really like it. I think the first Home Alone I probably put up in like the high 80s, maybe even low 90s. Like, I think that movie's pretty spectacular for what it is, but that's where I'm at. Where are you, Emily?
It's out of 92 or 99?
0 to 99.
Yeah. Okay, you go. I have to think about my life for a second.
So as I've stated frequently on this podcast, when I saw movies when I was like a kid, they were all either zeros or 99s. Like there was no middle ground. I want to say Home Alone 2 is the first movie. I liked it. I probably would have given it a 70. I probably would have been like, they didn't nail everything here. I don't know how I feel about that. Am I getting old? Am I going to die someday? Like that was my experience watching Home Alone 2. That was also my experience of watching it in my 40s that I was like, am I getting old? Am I going to die someday? I want to say coming into this podcast, I probably would have given it like a 42.
Okay.
But now after this conversation, I'm going to give it whatever Caroline gives it because she is a very good friend of mine and I love her very much and I want her to be happy. And it's Christmas time. So in the spirit of giving, I'm going to give it whatever Caroline gives it. Queer phobia rating, I'm going to give it a 4. There's just a few too many jokes that are like boys kissing boys. Wouldn't that be strange? That would never happen.
Oh, sure. The Cliff moment.
Yeah. Cliff's a looker. Like, they should be happy.
Cliff's got a very handsome mustache.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Well, now I'm like, I can't trust myself at all in this, but I'm going to take Emily's rating and I'm going to double it, baby. We're going to double it. And you're going to stick with that because you said you would.
84, baby.
We're giving it an 84.
I'm also giving this film an 84, which is weird because I'd probably give the first Home Alone an 80. But you know what? That's because this movie's better.
First movie, I'll give it 90. This one, I'm giving an 84.
Caroline, not to put you on the spot, but do you have any favorite Christmas movies? Just curious as to where you're, since it's that time of year, and as we wrap this up, I'm just curious as to some holiday cheer that you enjoyed as a kid or even now.
I mean, the thing is, like, I would probably say like the Home Alones, but I like the Homes Alone. those are very nostalgic for me. Sure. But I feel like, let me think. I'm trying to, I mean, I really love the original Grinch cartoon.
Sure.
The live action freaks me out. No, thank you. I respect the swing, but the original Grinch cartoon I love. And to bring this full circle to, I think we were having this conversation off mic, but the Peanuts Christmas special is excellent. I feel like for me, I think it was more like specials. I think like those are more was into. I missed a bunch of ones. I feel like I didn't watch It's a Wonderful Life for a really long time. My mom hated Christmas.
I mean, obviously,
stories.
Love Actually is your favorite Christmas movie.
Obviously, Love Actually. Oh my God. I mean, I really did like that movie until my mom watched it, like mostly silent, which is huge for her because she's a talker. She'll talk through every movie. And at the end of this behemoth film, because it's so long, she kind of just turns to me and she was like, why do all the women work for these men? All the women who like get with the guy, like they're all like his, like, you know, direct inferior. And I was like, fuck, you just ruined it forever. Like, I can never, every single one. She was like, I don't think so. But I really do think that one reason why I wanted to come on for this one is that I was like, these were so nostalgic in a very specific way. And I can't think of one I liked more than it, to be honest.
Emily, you did a Christmas draft, On Screen Drafts, if I'm not mistaken, correct?
Christmas adjacent, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Christmas, Christmas
definitely
adjacent,
forgetting some, so please throw some out there.
Yeah. And I do think it's interesting that, because I had this discussion with my roommate, who is a very big holiday movie person. Like, when I said I had to watch this movie, she's like, I can't be in the same room as this movie until December. Like, she's very strict rules.
I mean, I'm glad that I got to watch this in November versus October, I will say. It was correct.
Sure. Fair enough. But what's interesting is the rules that people have for Christmas movies in terms of what, you know what I mean? Emily, you obviously had these rules when you did your Christmas adjacent, but I just think it's interesting, like, Christmas, I'm assuming, needs to actually fold into the plot of the movie for it to be considered a Christmas movie.
I think so.
The impression?
I feel like people keep stretching the definition.
Right.
Yeah. We've gone from Christmas is featured somewhere to this movie came out at Christmas and I remember seeing it in theaters at that time. Which is fine. I do think to some degree, like, as we become a more diverse country that has more room for religious experiences other than Christianity, like, probably it is worth talking about movies that have that end of year vibe, but aren't necessarily directly Christmas related. But I do think, like, on the screen drafts we did, we came up with something called the Die Hard Gremlins line, which is basically Die Hard is not a Christmas movie because you could set that at another time and the plot would more or less make sense. And Gremlins is a Christmas movie because that story only makes sense at Christmas. So, like, that was kind of the line we came up with. And I think
that's smart.
You know, but there's a lot of, like, I think It's a Wonderful Life rides that line. Like, It's a Wonderful Life, you could probably set it at a time other than Christmas. You gain a lot from Christmas, but yeah. I don't know. Christmas, obviously, a thing that I think about a lot.
Christmas is great.
Yeah, what about you? Since, I mean, Christmas is not something you actively celebrate. I mean, so what does it mean? How did Christmas movies factor into, like, your childhood as, like, a genre?
Well, I appreciate the question, Caroline. Emily never asks me questions.
I listen.
It's true. Like, last night you texted me something that you thought I would think was a joke, and
you took it so seriously. I won't say, because it's maybe I'll want to force you to do it sometime. But
god damn it. So it was an episode idea. But to answer your question, Caroline, I do think that the movies that I associate with Christmas are Batman Returns, Die Hard, and Lethal Weapon. Those are Christmas movies to me.
Yeah.
It's not to say that I haven't seen lots of movies that take place at Christmas and probably have, but I just, like, I don't like Love Actually particularly.
No, it's bad.
It's not good.
It's straight up bad.
I also, like, I've never seen Miracle on 34th Street, which people say is great.
I feel like this takes some stuff from that for sure.
Right. I love Elf. I think Elf's a great Christmas movie. But again, like, it's weird, and it's also kind of, you just can't really think about it. Like,
it's a cartoon. That one's a cartoon.
Right. I prefer my Christmas movies to have sort of, like, Christmas in the background and Christmas to be a time that's happening.
A feature.
As opposed to something that's, yeah. But that's, I mean, listen, that's me. I like my Christmases with Catwoman and penguins, personally.
I mean, that's a fair line.
How do you feel about It's a Wonderful Life?
I like It's a Wonderful Life. I had not seen it. Truthfully, I'd never seen it until I saw it in the theater in Toronto pre-COVID. I want to say maybe it was 2018 or 2019. It was playing in Toronto and I'd never seen it. And I went with some friends. And who knew? Good movie, guys. Good movie. You know, great movie. I was just excited that I got to see it on the big screen too. Like to see that. It's a really beautiful looking movie. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that. Oh my God, why am I drawing a blank on the filmmaker? Jesus Christ,
Frank Capra.
Frank Capra, Jesus, yeah. Frank Capra's movies look beautiful. But yeah, I think it's a sad ass movie too. Like the fucking, it's just really
That's why I like it. My sister got so, like, she was scared of that movie. Like it freaked her out. I think she was a very anxious kid. And I think she thought about it way harder than I ever did. I was just like, oh, that everyone ends up happy. And she's like, but he's so sad.
I feel like Ruby has thoughts.
Oh yes. No, my dog always has thoughts.
She heard sad and Emily.
My God. She heard it. Or someone's at the door. But yeah, I don't know. And I think also, you know, there's something to the sort of like Christmas movies very much emphasize the like, it's about family and gathering and whatever. So I feel like at some point, like these movies become part of like your family memories. So for me, I'm mm-hmm. thinking about the movies I watched with my family. And that becomes. So for me, these are really nostalgic because I feel like these are some of like these are the movies that I know I can put on with my family and we will laugh at it every time. I tried to show them Elf, actually. We were watching. I had never seen it until kind of recently. So I was like, let's all watch it. And the stony silence with which my family greeted that film. It was
Will Ferrell fans, I take it.
My dad, like one of his favorite movies of all time is the Talladega Nights. And it was just, they could not vibe with whatever Elf was given. But it was the kind of thing where I was like, well, maybe I would have liked this movie if I didn't watch it with my family who hated it, you know?
Right.
Because that's not what they wanted from it. But I think that there is something to the, I think it's a fair criticism to be like the first one draws so strongly on those heartstrings of like, this is a family movie about family at Christmas. The second one, yeah, this could have happened at another time of year. He could have hit up the plaza at another time of year and done a whole thing that wasn't Christmas centric. The first one is so.
He couldn't have been a simp for Christmas trees.
He could
August.
Not have been a simp for Christmas trees. And that to me, you know, that would have been a tragedy. So let us, if there's anything else we can take from this film, let it be that.
Absolutely.
We have another Christmas episode coming up. So I will go deep on my weird, sad relationship to Christmas with Tom.
It does feel
Clay.
Like we have
with Tom Meissen and Clay Keller when we talk about,
but yeah, I just realized as Caroline was talking about her relationship to Christmas movies that like, I don't have that at all. And like, that's probably like part of my love of Christmas, I think, is that I had to make up all my own traditions as an adult. And like, I think that is, I don't know.
Well,
that's really powerful. And that's something that it's interesting too, that like that Kevin does that in the first movie.
His tradition is getting lost at Christmas time.
I do think though, to your point, Emily, that like what's so interesting is, again, I didn't celebrate Christmas in the strictest sense of the word. I had family dinners, obviously, that happened around the holidays. And we exchanged gifts and all of that. But like, it wasn't Christmas per se. And I do think that part of Christmas is just the vibe of walking around stores and hearing Christmas carols. And if you are in a place that has snow, that's even better. And I just think that it's a vibe and it's just a
cozy vibe.
It's a potential is the thing, right? Like it's the possibility of Christmas that I think is so lovely.
We are watching the show Bluey with our child because we are introducing them to television, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
And their Christmas episode is set in Australia, so it's a summertime thing. So like they have a barbecue, they go for a swim. That's and it still had that feeling. It still had that feeling of like, oh, there's going to be this moment of beautiful togetherness, even though we're all in a pool. And like, I don't know.
It's interesting because half this movie hinges on Kevin hating the idea of palm trees so much that he'd rather get lost in New York.
Correct. Which I love.
Which I love.
I have one last question for you, Caroline, before we let you go.
Yes.
Because I know you're a TV person, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask, do you have some favorite Christmas episodes? Do you have a favorite Christmas TV episode that comes to mind?
Well, it's interesting because when you asked about Christmas movies, I feel like I kept thinking about episodes. And there's an argument to be made that like the Peanuts special is a TV episode. So is the Grinch. Sure, like they were shown on TV like that. Yeah. I think those count more as TV than movies.
Absolutely. For sure.
So those, I will say the Hey Arnold episode, the Christmas Hey Arnold episode is really good, but also like absolutely devastating. It's one of the most devastating Christmas thing ever, which is like, it's one of the
You wrote about that residents. For us. You wrote about that for AV Club.
About the Hey Arnold Christmas episode?
I think you did.
Oh, I did. Oh, I did. Yeah. I thought you said you did. I was like, you just told me you'd never seen it. But if you had, if the only episode of Hey Arnold you had seen was the Devastating Christmas one, I wouldn't have been surprised. But it's like, it's about, like, you know, Arnold lives in a boarding house with his, that his grandparents run. And at Christmas, one of the residents is this Vietnamese man who hasn't seen his daughter in many years. And it's about Arnold reuniting them. And it's like lovely and sad and wonderful. So that one was great, but I find it very hard to rewatch because it genuinely makes me sad, even though it is ultimately a happy thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the Christmas, one of the, to bring this very full circle.
Great.
You know, Emily and I first met because of Community. I know, you know, Community, a very, like, you know, intense, fraught part of your writing career, but it did bring us together. So for that reason, it was worth it.
I told this story in our Memoirs of an Invisible Man episode, of course, which is, you know.
So
Chevy Chase brought you guys together.
Chevy Chase.
Yes, go to that one for our origin story. But I feel like, you know, then I, like, message you on Twitter to be like, you know, and then to be like, hey, big fan, et cetera. And you asked me to send you, like, a couple, like, I think, samples of my work. And I think one of them is something I had written about Abed's Uncontrollable Christmas. Mm-hmm. And it was about, like, you know, blue Christmases and sort of really loving that flavor of Christmas story, which I think the Hey Arnold episode is of a similar vibe, even if it's not stop motion.
Sure.
But would that one, I haven't rewatched in a very long time, but it does hold a special place because it brought me to one Miss Emily St. James. So
listen,
I would be remiss to not mention it.
Perfect.
Would you be surprised that from you sending me a thing that was like, I like sad Christmas things, I not only, like, gave you a job, but also a lifelong friendship?
I mean, you know, there we have it. Oh my God, I had this hat. I didn't even here. I brought a prop.
That's incredible.
I brought a hat that I was supposed to wear for this.
I should have worn a Christmas sweater.
I will for Muppet Christmas Girl.
Patrons, you can see me in a very big Christmas hat.
Yeah,
at this
tremendous
time,
guys.
Phil, before you take us out, which I know you're going to do, I am so pleased to announce that we have signed Catherine O'Hara to reprise her role in Home Alone Generations - Carly's Day Out. Maybe it should be Home Alone : Generations - Carly's Day Out.
Directed by David Fincher. Point.
Yeah.
Oh, Fincher's doing it. You got Fincher. Yeah.
We got Fincher. It's going to be a little bit more grounded take on the Home Alone franchise. So
watch out for that.
A little bit grittier too.
That's fantastic. Yeah. It'll be great. So Caroline, where can people read you, listen to you? Are there ways that they can? Are there social media things that you would want people to perhaps be following you?
I guess technically you can find me on the platform formerly known as Twitter. Even though I'm spending far less time there, I am a bit more on Blue Sky. I'm on Instagram somewhere. I'm a bit in between my writing things at the moment, but I have a website that I will ostensibly update someday.
Great.
I'm a writer about town lost in New York. That's the vibe these days.
Well, thank you so much for coming on, Caroline.
Thank you for having me. What a delight.
Come back in the future and talk about, I love that Emily's just waving. Awesome.
It's a keychain that says, lately I've been dressing for revenge. My mom found it under my TV
That's
stand.
That's incredible. Perfect. That's fantastic.
I'm still holding on to your table, by the way, Caroline. So if you ever come back to LA, you can have your table.
Oh my God. Excellent. Well, see, this was a productive call.
Yeah. It all worked out, guys. Thank you again for coming on, and you'll come on in the future and it'll be great.
Yes,
thank
please.
You so much.
All right. Merry Christmas to all and to all.
Merry
a good
Christmas.
Night.
Merry Christmas. Bye.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape.
And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.